is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 282 in the series. This session of the radio show shares my conversation with Horace Mann Education Association, or HMEA, President Michael Maloney. We had our conversation via conference bridge to adhere to the social distancing requirements of this pandemic period. In our conversation, we talk about how HMEA is adapting their service delivery under the circumstances of this pandemic, what services they provide to more than 4,000 people in over 100 communities, how their company Cloud for Causes is helping nonprofits with their technology needs, and how well the virtual Incredible Day 5K did fundraising. Links to the key webpage references we make are included in the show notes. The recording runs about 27 minutes. So let's listen to my conversation with Mike and learn more about what HMEA does for 4,000 people across 100 communities in Mass.
Okay, this is Steve Sherlock for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, WFPR-FM, and 102.9 on the radio dial in the Franklin area. Today, we're joined by Michael Maloney, the CEO of the Horace Mann Education Association, otherwise known as HMEA. Good morning, Mike. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning, Steve. Happy to be here on a sunny 80-degree day.
New England weather, who knows, right? We'll take it while it lasts.
Yes, been a little crazy. Yeah.
A little crazy. Never mind the weather. This other coronavirus thing has certainly put a dent into some of your operations. But before we get into that specifically, why don't you tell a little bit more about your role? Because I think your role, even as CEO, is going to be changing this year.
Yeah, so I've been privileged to be the CEO now for the past 20 years. And someone said, if you love what you do, you don't work a day in your life. So I've been really blessed to be able to spend time with people who represent diversity by virtue of having a disability, work with a lot of diverse staff, and also be on trade organizations that help influence policy across the state. So it's been the dream job of a lifetime, Steve.
Good. Nothing wrong with that. And if I recall from conversations with Doug McPherson, and we did at least a couple with him leading up to the virtual 5K, which was the Sunday before Memorial Day weekend, your services span over 100 communities and more than 4,000 individuals.
Yeah, that's right. So, Steve, the youngest person we've ever served is one. That's unusual. Somebody with a young child with autism, the oldest, 101.
Wow.
Roseanne at 101 lived in Attleboro. So, like you said, we serve over 4,000 people. We indirectly work information and referral for families who have kids with autism. They call our center. They're devastated with the diagnosis. They're asking for help, hope in a future, and they get that kind of inspiration from other families. They get to know docs and stuff like that. We have 100 people living in our residential group homes that we'll talk about a little bit later. Then we do a lot of in-home work with kids with autism called applied behavioral analysis. We have a small school for kids with autism. And then we support about 500 people with in day services, day programs. One of those programs is on Upper Union Street in Franklin, and about 100 people are supported there. So all told, about 4,000 people, more than that at different times. And we have 690 staff.
Wow, that's quite an operation. And yeah, for the record, based here, your headquarters are on Forge Park, if I recall correctly.
That's right. We moved, Steve, from 101 Constitution Boulevard all the way to Forge Park, you know. So we've been around the area for, 25 years.
Right. And then now you've expanded into that facility on the Upper Union. I believe that's the same location that I go to for my eye care.
Yeah, and it used to be a sports
the Boston Sports Club.
Where I took my first spinning class years ago. Yeah.
So, it's kind of like going back again, sort of.
That's right. And I do want to mention, I don't know if you plan to get into this, but we have one of the great state representatives in Jeff Roy, who's been a phenomenal supporter, not just locally in our race and things like that, but also on Beacon Hill.
Yeah, certainly in this kind of a conversation, getting through the discussion without mentioning him. In particular, the race, I remember he and you had kind of a private race, so-called, pushing wheelchaired individuals a couple of times, I think. It happened more than once.
Yeah, a couple times. Yeah, one year we wore superhero capes.
Yep.
And so Jeff was pushing Chris Biagiotti,
yes,
daughter, Kayla. And I expected to get, you know, a kind of a smaller woman. A woman from Worcester State showed up who uses a wheelchair, and I got to push her. So we struggled for 2 years up those hills. Jeff's head was red as a beet, and I wasn't doing too well either.
Yeah, it was for a worthy cause.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, the weather was good that day too, I think.
That's right.
Yeah, so you'll probably be spending a little bit more time with Jeff as you transition into your new role, which I believe happens July 1.
That's right. So we've had a careful board planned transition plan, and Jewel Gomes-Nowak, who has been at the agency for over 30 years, will succeed me as CEO, and I'll become a vice president for community and government relations. So Jeff has already sponsored a bill helping human service workers to pay for their college loans. But we are going to need money, Steve, to get through the next iterations of COVID-19, you know, PPE for our staff, things like that.
Sure.
We are also, even in this tough budget times, our staff who work on the front line should get reimbursed for that. So lots of legislative activity going forward.
Yeah, and the nature of your work, we can get into that, because while you're servicing autism and across the spectrum, you've mentioned already, I believe, residential sites, and a lot of your service delivery is effectively one-on-one. And under these circumstances, that makes a real challenge.
Yeah, exactly. So in a way, we are like nursing homes. So we have four people typically living in a group home, maybe five, and we may have two or three staff at a time. So social distancing, our staff are all wearing masks, is just about impossible. There's personal care for people. Mm-hmm. You know, people need very close contact. So it's a environment that really calls for very careful planning. The other thing is people, their day programs have been closed. So they're home 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we've had to staff up during that time with people, staff that are fearful of contracting COVID. And it's been really an heroic effort on the part of staff to do the work with the people that, frankly, in many cases, they love.
Right. Yeah, and the daycare programs, I think in the conversation with Doug, in some cases, you're able to, via technology like Zoom, or at least tap in with them periodically to have a session virtually.
Yeah. Yeah, so this overused word, pivot. So we were in the home of about 100 kids who have autism, you know, one staff to one child. And during the COVID, since the state of emergency, we haven't been doing that. So kids are having their applied behavior analysis sessions done through a remote, through Microsoft Teams. And then on the adult side, where the day programs are closed, we've been connecting with families, we've been connecting with the people we support, we've been doing virtual activities. So it's been a great learning experience. Like the rest of the world, we are Zoomed out, we are Microsoft Teams out. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of my days, like you, Steve, is spent in front of the computer screen and I'm not moving very much.
No.
But so, yeah, we've been fortunate that our staff, also we have a really fantastic IT department, and they were able to get us, you know, operational in a very short period of time.
Yeah, the technology certainly is critical, especially in these times, because for that particular audience, you know, schedule and routine is very important, as I recall. So, being with changes, that itself causes some adjustments on themselves. And that becomes more of a challenge. I know it's still early on, but are you finding the sessions via virtual at least helpful?
So on the children's side, about half of the families have chosen to do the virtual. And I know in our school, Steve, that's virtual as well. Schools are shut down, as you know.
Right. Yeah.
But families have actually sent letters talking about how important those sessions are. The fact that they're 18-year-old daughter with autism is not only happy to see a teacher but learn, but now she knows how to use Zoom and can communicate with her friends. So it's not the same as having a therapist in the home.
No, no. But nothing can compare to that. But yeah.
But people, you know, miss their teachers, of course. You know, I have a 7-year-old granddaughter and she said, "Grandpa, I just want to get back on the school bus.
Yes.
I want to see my friends." And it's the same with the people we support on the kids' side. On the adult side, as you mentioned, something that can be quite common with people with autism, as you mentioned, is routine. So not being able to go out in the morning to their day program, not being able to go out in the community at all, being kind of sequestered in their home has been a real challenge. So the staff not only meet, you know, the maybe the physical care needs, but also the emotional care needs of the people that we support. And it's about 100 people in our residential programs that live in 24 group homes.
Right. Yeah. My heart goes out to them. You mentioned technology. If I recall, you also have a kind of a, I'm not sure whether technically you call it a sub company or a subsidiary, but you have a company that does provide some technical infrastructure.
Yeah. So this is really cool. It's called Cloud for Causes. If you have the cause, we have the cloud. I thought of that late one night when we needed a name, the copyright wasn't taken. But so years ago, we got very big infrastructure donations from EMC at the time and Cisco.
Right.
All told over the years, probably $750,000.
Wow.
So our vice president of IT came up to me and said, "Mike, this could be a business. We can offer support to nonprofits. Nonprofits don't have the budget or the knowledge to adopt the best IT. And,
right.
and usually when they hire contractors, they're not sure what they're getting."
Yep.
So at this time we have over 30 customers. Most of them are, we host their electronic records, but a number of them, like the York of Massachusetts, we do all of their IT services. We order computers, we image the computers, we do help desks, we do fix-its, we do networking. Our biggest customer, Naugatuck, has, you know, hundreds of staff, and we are literally their IT company. The chief technology officer is a former Cisco employee, and our vice president of IT is a former AAA IT guy. And then we have two nerds who are like fantastic. They fly, I'm serious about this, they fly drones around the office, you know, but they're just awesome. They're all working from home. And because our equipment is so up to date, most of the work can be done virtually. So yeah, I'm really proud of that company. We speak the language of nonprofits and we offer, you know, big discounted prices given the more commercial companies.
Sure. Yeah, that's one of the things where in my role for Franklin Matters in particular, I've been exposed to a lot of things within Franklin. And while respectfully, the Franklin Downtown Partnership has created kind of a, you know, the table where, you know, the circle of small business groups can get together and, you know, cry in their beer, so to speak, from time to time. But at least, you know, communicate, share common items. Franklin now, I believe you're aware, has a cultural district so that all the performing arts organizations can now get together to do something similar. What I'd like to do is bring together the nonprofits. In my research so far, there's at least 90 or so that are based here in Franklin. And that's one of the hidden gems, I think, that, you know, that tech company of yours, while you may be one of the larger companies, how many people really know about that other than me? So I want to bring other key stakeholders from the nonprofit sector together so that they're at least aware that, one, the services you do provide from a nonprofit perspective, but then, oh, by the way, you also do this tech stuff. So if the nonprofit is at a point where they're considering either whether it's a Google service for their email or wanting to do something else, you can at least help in that decision process.
Yeah, we could do help with free assessments, for example. Steve, mm-hmm. I was involved with something like this back in Attleboro, maybe 15 years ago, where there was an organized community of nonprofits, including communities of faith. And I think Now is the time. I think everyone's crying in their beer, but solutions going forward, things won't be the same. No. So I think exchange of ideas leading to perhaps innovation, maybe there's grant funding available, that kind of stuff is community building at this point is needed.
Yeah, because I think if anything, the pandemic has given us that the time to say, you know, do we really want to go back to the way we were?
Yeah.
Maybe the way we were wasn't the best way to do things. In conversations, even with the town of Franklin, I know that they're even the payroll, for example, prior to the pandemic, somebody had to be in the office in order to run the payroll. Well, they figured out how to do that remotely. So somebody doesn't need to be there anymore. No, and that's just an example of other, you know, efficiencies that are now being figured out and getting back to the basics, so to speak. What is it you're really trying to do? And the nonprofits across the spectrum are all trying to service their communities in their various ways. If there's some commonalities in terms of whether it's structure or technology, and the left hand can share with the right hand, that's a win-win. So.
Absolutely. And you know, I know Jeff is kind of a unifying force there, but that new, is it Contolo or Controlo?
Contolo Mass Manufacturing, yes.
Isn't that something, right?
Yep.
So that's a remarkable asset. In my understanding, I think Jeff told me that that gentleman is also interested in developing some cultural things within that space there.
It's right? Quite possible. Clearly, the old Clark Cutler McDermott plant along 140. Bordered by Fisher Street and Haywood, has been redesignated as a mixed business innovation district. I was fortunate to be part of that, you know, unveiling, if you will, or opening when they did their first production run. I still have some video I haven't edited yet of that, but everybody was wearing, you know, masks and appropriately socially distanced. Senator Spilka was there, Rep. Roy was there. And yeah, for those who haven't heard the story, a gentleman who had a number of years ago worked at Clark Cutler, after Clark Cutler closed, he moved out of state. He remembered this particular machine that had the capability, effectively it's a giant cookie cutter. So picture a piece of cloth, perhaps, you know, 8x10 on a big roll, draw the design and then you know, and it cuts. And now you've got a gown, and the material, of course, is critical. They've sourced so that I believe they're the type 3 or type 4. And there's a whole spectrum of, you know, PPE for different arenas, as opposed to similar to kind of the cloth masks that we can wear, as opposed to the N95 masks, which are more for the frontline healthcare workers, et cetera. So yeah, they're operational, and in a matter of, you know, from a phone call to what, maybe 6 weeks later, they had that production run. That's an amazing story.
That is stunning. Absolutely stunning.
And it is still a big facility. Like clearly, even when they get full, they're not going to be operationally using that much space. So I'm sure there's something else that can fit in there. So stay tuned.
Yeah, we're, of course, the cultural aspect. We have a Beatles cover band fundraiser at the Black Box Theater.
Yes.
Yep. And that is such a blast. You know, we raise, you know, $8,000 or $9,000 and just have a great time with our community.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and you managed to have that one in person before the pandemic hit, right?
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Hopefully, we'll gradually kind of work through this, you know, flattening the curve, so to speak, and gradually get back into some, you know, organizational type meetings and gatherings. Because yeah, the cultural aspects, it's nice to see the BSO and or, you know, Yo-Yo Ma or even Jamie Barrett and some of the other Franklin School for Performing Arts via YouTube, etc. But nothing beats being in person for a bit, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think we touched on certainly your background, your transition, the services you provide, the tech piece from the tech services, and we'll get into that kind of nonprofit roundtable at some point, hopefully in the near future. Is there something else that we need to cover or should cover to help folks understand the breadth and depth of the services you provide from a HMEA perspective?
Not really. I think beyond HMEA, though, we are looking for what people call urgent collaborators. So we need to get outside of ourselves and work with other organizations to create change. So we need to figure out what should be kept of the current system, what we need to shed, and what we need to innovate into. So, you know, I'm in touch, Jewel is in touch with other leaders of major organizations in Massachusetts. Change doesn't always come top down from government. We think it could come from the field. We in fact are closest to people. Mm-hmm. So that is really significant. So we do spend a lot of time with other organizations thinking about the future and how to innovate. The other thing we're doing, Steve, across 33 organizations is we have developed an electronic record system, an electronic health record. HMEA built it, and now there are 33 organizations. About 13,000 people with disabilities have their data in there. And DDS, our funder, only serves 42,000 people. So we have about 30,000 people, 30% of the people. And what we're doing now is embarking on a health data tracking project with UMass. So going into the fall, we want to make sure everybody we support has the flu shot, had their physical, had, you know, all of the preventative care. So when it comes back. And we are also now starting to track COVID data. So for example, Steve, we at HMEA, we've had 47 positive cases. 18 are people who live in our residences and 29 are staff. And we've had 11 COVID hospitalizations. So we're going to start that tracking that data. How many people have been tested? How many people have contracted COVID? What was the isolation period and things like that? So data, I think, is a strategic advantage. And any organization that wants to exist into the future needs to show its worth to funders, for example. So that's the space we occupy and look forward to growing.
Yeah, database decisions certainly make for better ones. And then obviously in your space between HIPAA compliance and other privacy pieces, I'm sure you've got the security wrapped around that and developing the protocols accordingly, because that's always a concern. But if you can make that case, then the people are going to come and you'll have the service for them to meet their needs.
Exactly. And through, this is maybe a little too deep inside baseball, but the system is shifting to something called accountable care, because Medicaid is about 40% of the state budget. So they're looking at ways to improve quality while cutting costs. And that's through demonstrating value. So do our people go to the emergency room more than a typical population? We know, Steve, we have a great record with medication errors. We do better than hospitals. So by knowing your numbers, by knowing how you perform, you know, you are able to demonstrate, you know, value for the people you support and for the Commonwealth.
That's exciting. And well, before I think of it too, and we certainly before we close, we want to get back to kind of the virtual day. While it was virtual, you did have a number of runners, clearly not the 200 to 300 that I would help do the registration desk for that particular day, but it still was relatively successful overall.
Yeah, so we had 65 runners. We had, let me see, I'm looking at my stats here. We had 215 walkers, but this is cool, Steve. We had all of these virtual events. Right. We had 41 different virtual events like dance parties, music trivia. Our video had 2,800 views. And in the end, and this is stunning, and I am so grateful to our community, we raised about $120,000, which is just amazing during this time. So I'm so grateful. I'm emotionally grateful because we've lost a lot of revenue sources during this particular time. The finances have been the most challenging in our 50-year history. So we really appreciate the help from the community.
Yeah, and the cost of delivery, you know, just with the PPE, et cetera, never mind some of the hazard pay, your cost of delivering the services has just, you know, taken, I don't know if it's a factor leap or whatever, but there's an increase there.
Steve, if I could mention one thing. So in order to, we closed, based on the governor's state of emergency, our day services. Again, 500 people in 9 sites attend those.
Right.
We closed on March 15th.
Yep.
And in our residences, we knew we couldn't keep people safe necessarily if they got COVID. So we stood up an isolation center in Millbury within a few weeks, and that's to contain the spread. So a gentleman named Scott living in Attleboro, I've known him for 30 years, he contracted COVID. He was our first person at the isolation center, you know, scared, lonely.
Yeah.
And one of his staff volunteered along with our nurses to get PPE'd up and stay with him for 2 weeks. So, and when Scott came out of that isolation center, the hallway was filled with the isolation center staff. A nurse played the song, "Here Comes the Sun." And Scott marched triumphantly and well out of the isolation center. So even though we've had 47 cases, we are very, very fortunate to not have any deaths. I think there have been about 65 deaths of people with intellectual disabilities.
Right.
So it's been like you hear heroes all the time, but our staff, again, direct support workers going into very difficult situations, staying overnight, quarantining in their homes, leaving their families. It's been something to behold. It's been great.
Quite the story. And while the virtual day has happened, I believe you're still open to any additional donations, even beyond your fiscal year, June 30th. Clearly, your needs and services are going to go beyond that. So if somebody wants to donate, they can go to hmea.org. I believe there's a donut button. That's a donate button, rather, not donut. Excuse me. I'll edit that out.
Yeah, I'd reference that, Steve.
There is a donate button that's rather prominent on the page.
Steve, I appreciate the opportunity. This has been great to chat with you. And I want to personally thank you for the support of HMEA during the years. Not only, you know, Franklin Matters, but you have been on our committee. I know you give of your time and yourself to our cause, and we truly appreciate that. So we were named after Horace Mann.
Yes.
You know, born in Franklin, said, yep, be ashamed to die unless you have won some victory for humanity. So we thank you for your contribution, Steve.
Thank you. It's a worthy cause, and I'm glad to help. Well, thank you for taking your time this morning to do this particular Zoom thing. We'll give you some screen time to take a break before your next one, and get a walk break in there too. I watered my garden before doing this, and I got to go to the community garden and do my other portion there. So take care of yourself. Thank you for doing this, Mike, and I'm sure we'll be in touch along the way.
Okay. Thanks very much, Steve.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio, WFPR-FM. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. You can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.